Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, April 27th. We're going to go out of order today on the agenda. We're going to start out with House Bill 2287, then go to 2082, and then House Bill 2355. I have another announcement to make. We pulled House Bill 3399, which is a bicycle bill, off the agenda because we discovered it had a huge fiscal that we weren't anticipating, and there were some other problems as well. And I want to thank the Bicycle Coalition and Mary McO'Donnell for bringing this to us, and Representative Tobias Reed and I expect to work on it during the interim, and working with some Deputy District Attorneys from Multnomah County so that it will work both fiscally and legally, not have the unintended consequences showed up with. They open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2287.
Yes, members, House Bill 2287 with the dash twos is the revenue package proposal from the Judicial Department. We took a look at this on Friday. Ledge Council issued dash two amendments, the only change being that it inserts the language that it being a revenue-raising measure, it requires a three-fifths majority, and those were delivered to your offices. You also have a chart that outlines the types of fees being increased or the types of new fees. And we are waiting. We don't have a fiscal or revenue impacts yet. We have the Chief Justice in the Kingsley Clark in the audience if you have further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash twos into House Bill 2287.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash twos House Bill 2287. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2287 as amended without the fiscal impact statement being available for review.
And without the revenue.
And without the revenue.
Without the fiscal and revenue, I'm sorry.
Representative Wisnant moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2287 as amended without the fiscal or revenue impact statements being available for review. The motion is undebatable. Those who are of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2287 as amended without the fiscal and revenue impact statement being available will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Aye.
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 No. One no. Thank you. Motion carries. The rules have been suspended.
The rules be suspended.
Aye.
We still need a minute. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2287 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass record.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2287 as amended, Ways and Means with a due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. Open a hearing on House Bill.
Oh, work session.
I'm sorry, work session, House Bill 2802.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2802 is the removes the $500,000 non-economic cap on wrongful death and other statutorily created causes of action. It has a dash six amendment, and the dash six amendment places the cap at $1.5 million, indexes the cap based on the Oregon-Washington Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers starting in 2010, applies to causes of action before, on, or after the effective date, and takes effect 91 days after signing that. This has no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued, and the fiscal impact is indeterminate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we need the dash two, then?
The dash six.
Dash six, is that?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash sixes into House Bill 2802.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash sixes into House Bill 2802. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a pretty good compromise. However, when you index it, it's just like I said a couple of years ago with the minimum wage index. by 2025, a hamburger is $25 in Oregon. That's where it's going. And indexing, I would have much rather had the people who are going to be here long after I am gone, Representative Barton and others, take a look at this and see the need for that to come up. We should have kept control of that and not just automatically index it. I think over the long term, it actually hurts the judicial system and justice system.
Okay, thank you. And there is look back after 8 years to review that.
Actually, Mr. Cho, there is not.
Oh, it's been removed.
Took it out.
Because
okay.
That was going to have a fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can we have some discussion about the compromise between the advocates or...
As you recall, the original cap was $500,000, and this one moved it up. We took a look at various, the people talked about it, looked at the USHU settlements and so on, and moved this up to $1.5 million as the starting point. There was discussion from $1 million to $2 million, and that was the...
Mr.
Representative Olson.
Barton, myself, worked on this with Tom Holt, and he's in here, and I don't know if he wants to share any with that, but you know, we spent a few hours working on this compared to what the bill originally was with removing a cap, and this is where we came. And we did some serious homework over on the Senate side as well with this.
Thank you. Appreciate your work. And also, it was when I said it was 1 to 2 million, actually it was to infinity originally. There was to be no cap.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you. And was it a unanimous or consensus agreement? And was the indexing discussed too? Is that
Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I should say this bill for me personally is very significant, and I have very strong mixed feelings about it, frankly. It's not my place to speak for the Oregon Trial Lawyers. It's my understanding that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association is opposed to this bill. The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association is opposed to any cap of any kind, and indeed, I can say that a cap is quite repugnant to me, and I don't know that I'm welcome home at Christmas anymore. But that said, Mr. Holton and Representative Olson really have been a pleasure to work with. They have negotiated in good faith. And while I'm very concerned, it is with mixed feelings, because I fear, I think correctly, that this compromise will, especially when you include the index, will essentially enshrine this cap in place for a generation or more. And very much relieve the political pressure to ever remove the cap, which I would love to see happen. I do believe this is what's right for Oregon, and I think that at least amongst Representative Olson, Mr. Holt and his clientele, and myself, I think there was consensus on this bill. I cannot, the trial lawyers were not part of that consensus.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to let Representative Barton know that I have a place setting at my home.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move, we have to go to Ways and Means now. I move that House Bill 2802 as amended be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2802 to the floor with a due pass.
As amended.
As amended.
Did we put the dash six in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Excused.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carried. Representatives Olson and Barton, would you co-carry that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Public hearing on House Bill 2355, and following this, we're also going to have a discussion hearing on second look information. informational hearing.
House Bill 2355 modifies mandatory minimum sentences for specified crimes.
Tim Hartnett, Ryan Deckert, Dana Hepper, and Chip Shields, please.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I'm state representative for District 43, representing North and Northeast Portland. I'm passing around to you the testimony from Chiquita Rollins, a member of the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council in Multnomah County, and Multnomah County's Domestic Violence Coordinator, and she is writing in support of House Bill 2355. I thank the chair particularly for providing this hearing and for giving us the opportunity to begin this discussion about how to improve sentencing in this state. In 2007, representatives of the Oregon District Attorneys Association approached me with the idea of negotiating around decreasing the sentences for the lesser Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentences, the second degree offenses. So I'm reintroducing that idea in House Bill 2355, and I sought to balance those decreases in sentencing with a substantial increase in sentence for the crime that I believe most terrifies my constituents and most likely all of yours as well, which is rape in the first degree, which is usually stranger-to-stranger rape. In this bill, increases that sentence from 100 months to 120 months. I've also passed out to you the initial brief analysis of the fiscal savings that the bill would provide. Several biennium out, that is $10 million. That's the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to pass it on to the rest of the panel now.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Tim Hartnett. I'm Executive Director of CODA, a drug and alcohol treatment agency that helps men and women become clean and sober in Portland, East Multnomah County, and Clackamas and Washington counties. Many of these individuals are involved in the criminal justice system. I am here today as president of the Oregon Prevention, Recovery, and Education Association, an organization of 28 treatment and prevention agencies from around the state. We represent the overwhelming majority of treatment and prevention providers in the state. OPRA is a proud member of the Promise of Measure 57 Coalition, a coalition of individuals and organizations working to find a better way to fight crime. The Promise of Measure 57 Coalition includes the Oregon Business Association, the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and its members like Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the Oregon Nurses Association, and the Clackamas County Department of Human Services, and the Association of Oregon Counties. In the Governor's Office, many legislators, Oregon's 36 district attorneys, and all of us who endorsed Measure 57 promised that treatment funding would be increased by $40 million. We believe that many voters voted for Measure 57 in November 2008 because of the priority given to alcohol and drug treatment. You may have seen the floor letters on your desks over the last couple months, like the ones attached to my testimony supporting this view. Our developing coalition has come to the conclusion that revenue increases alone will be nowhere near the amount necessary to fulfill the promise of Measure 57. The government budget increased treatment in the Oregon Department of Corrections budget by only $20 million, not $40 million, and it cut the drug, treatment, and community mental health budgets in the Department of Human Services by $49 million and $35 million, respectively, a phenomenon some have called robbing Bruce Goldberg to pay Max Williams. Finally, it cut the community corrections budget by an additional $15 million for a total deficit of $119 million compared to the essential budget level. And as the state's financial condition worsens, the coalition is fighting just to keep the treatment system alive. The co-chair's current proposed budget cut list led to a substantial loss in alcohol and drug treatment capacity and infrastructure. Residential treatment programs cobbled together from a variety of funding sources, community development block grants, local capital campaigns, grants, etc., that have taken decades to build will simply fail and close. Several not-for-profit treatment providers, once the state and county's contract with the corrections alcohol and drug treatment, will fail and go out of business. Should this happen, Oregonians will be left to wait several decades before these treatment resources can be recreated. Virtually all of these agencies run on a razor-thin margin. If you think this point is exaggerated, imagine trying to provide housing, 3 meals a day, 24-hour staffing, coordinate services with community corrections officers, assist with housing, employment, and health care, and provide intensive treatment services on $105 a day, all while being in compliance with a variety of federal, state, local, and other regulatory requirements. I cannot think of another health care service that brings such dollar value. Let there be no doubt, we are at a critical policy and financial crossroad. Failing to support treatment in the morning leads to increased costs in the criminal justice, child welfare, and health care systems in the afternoon, that very same day. Alcohol and drug abuse represents one of the largest cost drivers for criminal justice, law enforcement, and correction systems. Somewhere between 70 to 90% of all those who commit crimes struggle with an alcohol or drug use disorder or are under the influence of the substance at the time they committed the crime. All this at a time when we know that alcohol and drug treatment can reduce crime, increase employment, enhance public health, and keep families intact. House Bill 2355 recognizes that we need to save money in both the short and long term and to restore balance to our public safety system. Because true public safety is about more than just building more and more prisons, it's also about crime prevention, Head Start, services for victims of domestic violence, better funding for alcohol and drug treatment, and proper funding of state troopers and our courts. And unfortunately, the state budget is a zero-sum game. House Bill 2355 is a starting point for an important conversation, a conversation on how to prioritize sentencing in order to restore balance to this public safety system that is on a trajectory for collapse. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director for Stand for Children. And both Stand for Children and the Oregon Alliance for Children programs are part of the Promise of Measure 57 coalition. And Stand for Children is supporting House Bill 2355, but I think even more importantly, we're supporting the approach driving House Bill 2355 that brings a more balanced approach to protecting kids in Oregon. Because we know, all, of course, that prisons are one important piece of making sure that kids grow up in safe communities, but there's more to protecting kids than just ensuring we have prisons. All children are depending on us to enact a balanced approach, and I just wanted to give a few examples of the type of balance I'm talking about and the difference it makes for kids. When I was teaching school, in addition to the standard fire drill, my kids also went through a safety drill, which was essentially to prepare us for the probably inevitable incident that were there gun violence close to the school, if that gun violence were to carry over into our school playground, that the kids would be ready to do whatever they could to protect themselves. So a few times a year, my kids practice huddling under their desks and moving away from windows so that, and I locked the door and called the front office so that we'd be prepared in case that ever happened. Well, it didn't, we didn't actually have to use that drill. During my year there, there were 3 gun violence deaths in within our school district boundaries that school year. And so one of the ways in which we have to ensure we have balance is, of course, we need an adequate police force, and, of course, that costs money. The strain on the DOJ budget means that criminal convictions of people who hurt kids may not be able to be adequately tried in our appellate court. And also wanted to remind you that last session, this body passed Carly's Law to fight child abuse. But unless we're able to rebalance the public safety system, the child abuse multidisciplinary investigation teams won't be able to adequately investigate child abuse in this state. During my last year of teaching, 3 students disclosed some kind of abuse to me that they were experiencing at home. And I asked you to just imagine a child who finally garners the courage to say to an adult that they're suffering abuse at home, and then that abuse disclosure is not able to adequately be followed up upon. I imagine that that child is not going to speak up again. I also just wanted to talk to about a certain population of kids whose parents are in the public's in the justice system or who have committed abuse or neglect of their children, because this is a especially important population of kids that depends on us to enact a balanced approach. Last, and there's some things at risk this biennium for those kids. Last biennium, Oregon invested $10 million to help mothers stay with their children while going through treatment instead of having DHS assume custody of those children. And if we don't rebalance the public safety system, this is an example of treatment dollars that are at risk. Last biennium, Representative Barker and Representative Shields played a key role in increasing funding for domestic violence services in the Department of Justice budget. But unless we can rebalance the public safety system, more women and children will be unable to break out of the cycle of domestic violence and child abuse. When I was teaching, I got a phone call on Friday night. I give the kids my phone number so that they can call me up with homework questions. But this family called me with a question about what to do because the father in the family had come home, was coming down from a meth high, and was going crazy in their trailer and kicking them out and hitting the mom, and they didn't know where to go. And fortunately, I was able to connect them with the services they needed, but what if those services just aren't there? Finally, an underfunded foster care system with underfunded courts won't be able to protect kids in dependency cases. Cuts to public defense services means that bigger caseloads for lawyers who represent abused kids. Students that are in foster care, and a student that I had in my class in foster care, these kids already don't have a voice. And they're dependent upon adults with incredibly limited time and incredibly overloaded workloads to be an effective voice for them. And my student, eventually, we were able to build a case to remove her from her home after a whack with a broomstick. But my concern is, what if she had reported abuse and we hadn't followed up adequately enough or given her adequate representation? I just can't imagine what it would be like for her to be back in her home. So in addressing the state's budget crisis, we must think about the long term and the short term. And House Bill 2355 represents the kind of long term approach to increasing some sentences while decreasing others, and sets us on the right path of setting the right priorities, and hopefully will help us get our public safety system back into balance. Kids need more from us than just prisons, more than concrete, bars, and barbed wire, and we hope you will stand with us, stand with Stand for Children, in moving towards a more balanced approach this biennium when it's going to be incredibly urgent to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Distinguished Chair Barker and Vice Chair Wisnett and your fellow Vice Chair Stiegler, if she was here, and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon. My name is Ryan Deckard. I'm the president of the Oregon Business Association. We are a statewide business organization representing a diversity of Oregon industries, ranging from the largest farm in the state to Oregon's two Fortune 500 companies. Mr. Chair, we started to look at the entire budget as a whole, not just for this biennium, but for the future bienniums to come. And after we did two exercises, one is plugging the federal stimulus dollars and the one-time funds that you have available to yourselves, we started looking for areas that we would cut as we tried to develop floors which the business community felt we should not go under. Then we obviously, as we looked at the budget, added in revenue options, and we presented our plan for the business contribution last week. We're here today, Mr. Chair, to talk about areas that came up within that budget framework that we felt were unavoidable for Oregon going forward. And as we looked at the growth in the corrections budget, and I think we're one of, what, five states that actually spends more on corrections than we do on higher education, as we looked at areas where you could cut to invest or slow the growth up, this was one area that we felt there was a business case to be made for taking a look at. And I can't speak exactly to what's in House Bill 2355, but I would like to talk to the committee about the four recommendations that we did make. The first recommendation that OBA has made is to delay the implementation of Measure 57. We think, given the economic catastrophe or crisis that is coming to the state in terms of the loss of revenue, that the state simply does not have the funds at this point to implement Measure 57. The second recommendation is that we would withhold the bonds, selling the bonds on the Junction City Prison, and is very much to the first point of, as our corrections budget has grown, it has crowded out other important investments that the state makes, and we don't feel that taxpayers are going to be interested in the type of investment that it would take to fund the other arenas in the budget with the sale of the Junction City bonds. The two other areas that we make recommendations, Mr. Chair, would be, one is to at least join Representative Shields in the work that group is doing, the coalition, around drug treatment dollars. We endorsed Measure 57. We believed it was an important measure, though certainly a different economic time than we're in 7 months later. But we do think the promise of treatment dollars, as the first witness testified to, is one that if Measure 57 moves forward would be one that we would endorse. And the fourth one, and it's the one that we're most interested in having a conversation with Oregonians in the long term, is about, and it fits into the tax structure as a whole, is what are the priorities of the state of Oregon and how do we get funding in place? And we think that looking at the legacy of initiatives that were passed in the 90s, whether that be property tax limitations across the state, or with very unequal permanent rates from Jackson County to Umatilla County to Morrow County, very unequal permanent rates in the property tax. We also feel that this is an area that at least bears discussion with the general population of Oregon, and we, for one, would join elected leaders in having that conversation in terms of some of the major initiatives that this state passed in the 1990s. Mr. Chair, that is my testimony. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions for the next panel? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Steve Dole, Doug Harkelrode, and John Foote, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I've been doing prosecution work since 1974, so I get to do some history fairly quickly for you here. Before sentencing guidelines, we had A, B, and C felonies, 20 years, 10 years, and 5 years. Judges had discretion. They could sentence all the way from probation, which back then was not a right as it is under sentencing guidelines, it was a privilege, to the 20-year maximum or the 10-year maximum or the 5-year maximum. Prisons were in short supply, or prison beds were in short supply. And so a judge would give somebody 3 years and they would do 30 days. The pressure release valve was the parole board. We were putting them in the front door and letting them out the back door, so to speak. And it wasn't a very good system. So there was an effort by law enforcement and certainly the legislature to create sentencing guidelines. And a lot of work went into that. I'll just shortcut that and say they were passed. And we got those in November 1, 1989. Being passed out to you right now is a black and white sentencing guidelines grid. I went back to my old books and I pulled out the original grid, this black and white, made a copy for you. And we use those those guideline grids to sentence people for very serious crimes. And what I'd like to point out just briefly on the grid, and by the way, with only very minor changes, this grid is the same grid as we have today for sentencing guidelines. And so if you look at the category 11, 10, 9, and 8, and you're all familiar with how to do that, now you've been doing it a bunch, you will see that murder over in the I column, which was no prior record, is 120 to 121 months. That was a 10-year sentence. Moving down to 10, manslaughter, assault 1, rape 1, and arson 1 were all 58 to 60 months. So call that 5 years. You need to remember that it's 20% off for good time. So it's really 4 years under sentencing guidelines for the most serious rape available. It's the sodomy assault, the most serious assault available, etc. And then you go down and you see the category 9, and there's a first-degree rape that's only a 34 to 36 month with 20% off. The long and short of 8, 9, and 10, and 11 is for 4 or 5 years there, we had very short sentences for very serious crimes. And so basically what happened, although there were some bills presented to the legislature, nothing happened in terms of those moving forward to lengthen those out. And we got ballot measure 11 in 1995. At that time it was 19 very serious crimes and with significantly longer sentences, but no sentence longer than 10 years except for murder. And it passed by 67% of the vote. And you might be interested to know that, and you all know that that was an initiative measure, and certainly Kevin Mannix was a principal participant in that. A matrix was developed to try to figure out where these sentences should be placed. And relative severity of the offense, more serious offense should have a longer sentence. There was some look at the actual sentences that we'll be giving, which I mentioned were pretty short. Definition of crimes and the relative violence associated with those crimes. And then what was the least sentence a person should serve? And there was some look at incapacitating long enough for those people to get some sort of education, GEDs, as well as there was a work measure that was passed, too, so they learned to work. The long and short of all that is that in 2000, there was a repeal measure put on the ballot to repeal it, and it lost with a 74% vote. So that's kind of the brief history of all this. And you need to be very careful about changing it without looking at what the history was, and that conversation actually sounds like a good idea to me. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. I will continue on a little bit with the history and then go into some of the efficacy of the measure. In 1993, there were some bills brought in front of the legislature to change sentencing guidelines. One was to place within the guidelines, or on a separate bill, I should say, automatic remand for juveniles 15 through 17 for first degree crimes. That bill passed through the House on a 54-4 vote and went to the Senate and was effectively killed in the Senate, even though there were votes on the floor to get it passed. At the same time, people who passed the sentencing guidelines that Mr. Hawkerode talked about in 1989, many at the time were unhappy with the numbers that were plugged into the guidelines. They thought that particularly around violent crimes, there should be higher numbers and that there should not be probation allowed, because virtually you could get probation for any crime in Oregon with the exception of murder. That was looked at also in 1993 and it was rejected. So that at that point was the genesis for Measure 11, and as you know, Measure 11 was passed in 1994 by almost 66% of the vote. And went into effect in April of 1995. Now, I gave you a packet. I would love to have given the whole Measure 11 presentation here today, but time restricts us from doing that. So I'll go through this very briefly. On your first, if you look at this packet that's stapled together, on your first graph there, you'll see the crime rate from 1960. And you see from 1960 to 1985, the violent crime rate, this is violent crime rate only, and only the FBI index crimes, that crime rate rose 7.9 times, 800% over those years. And the legislatures and the leadership's response in this state during that time period was to build one new prison with 400 beds. From 1995 to 2002, Oregon's violent crime rate dropped 44%, while the national rate dropped 28%. In 1994, Oregon ranked 42nd among states in prison incarceration, and we currently rank 30th. So we've hardly become a penal colony, as some would indicate. Now, there are those who would tell you that, well, crime went down all over the United States. It wasn't, you know, Measure 11 didn't have anything to do with it. Well, I would beg to differ with that. If you look at the second graph in this set of graphs that I gave you, set of charts, you'll see that the blue line is the same line as you saw on the original chart, and the red line is the national crime rate. You'll see that the national crime rate started dropping back in about 1990. And what our opponents will never tell you is this, that back in the late 80s and early 90s, 33 states increased time served for violent crimes. 23 states imposed and enacted three strike and you're outlaws. We're on the third strike. You go down for a 25-year to life sentence. And last but not least, virtually every state in the union by 1994 had imposed some type of mandatory minimum sentence. The next chart you'll see is a percentage of decrease in the crime rate in the state of Oregon from 1995 to 2006. We're currently second in the country, but from 1995 to 2002, we were number one. Two more charts, and like I say, this is a part of a much longer presentation that I would hope to have an opportunity to give you all someday, not to necessarily talk you into supporting Measure 11, but so you know exactly what you're voting for or voting against. Measure 11 election results. You can look at them by county. Look at your county. Measure 94 election results, when the attempt was made to overturn and repeal Measure 11. Last but not least, there's two more sheets in your packet that was handed out.
Crime Victims United and its partners
have never been obstructionists when it comes to changing Measure 11. You'll see that over the course of years, we've enacted the 1049 exceptions that I think we've talked to you about before. Senate Bill 1049 in 1997 and House Bill 2397 in 2001. And these provide a judge in second-degree cases, the very crimes we're talking about in this bill. This allows a judge to look at a person who is convicted of Measure 11, and when there is no use of a weapon, when there is no prior violent felony offense, and when there is no significant injury to the victim, the judge can pull the defendant out, or the convicted, I should say, out of the Measure 11 mandatory minimum and give them a sentence on the grid to include 20% good time. Now, this represents the savings over the years on that, which are significant. But I know it's, what have you done for me lately? But we did do this. And this just gives you an idea of the last sheet of the Measure 11 sentences. You can see that on assault twos, 61% of the people who came in front of the judges got a downward departure. 61% in kidnap two, 47% in rob two. The sex crimes are a little less because they only apply to juveniles. And as you know, we brought a bill in front of you this year, 3341, to take care of the rest of that situation and hope that you take a strong look at that. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Foote.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do you want to wait until the panel is done, or is now an appropriate time?
Why don't we wait and then...
Great.
My name is John Foote. I'm the DA in Clackamas County, and appreciate having a chance to talk to you today about this. First of all, I want to say a couple of things. The measure, the bill that's in front of you today, has nothing to do with money, in my opinion. won't save any money in the next biennium, or the one after that. So I'm curious why people are up supporting it for financial reasons, because it will have no impact. It's not retroactive, and it doesn't take effect until 58 months into somebody's prison sentence. That's just not going to provide any financial impact in the next 4 years. But that's not why we oppose it, because Measure 11 is really not about money. It's about the safety of the public. You know, when Measure 11 was passed, when it went to the voters, most prosecutors sat on the sidelines. We've been trying in the legislature to get things done to increase the sentences for violent crime without success, but we were still trying. And since Measure 11 is passed and gone into law, it has proved, in our opinion, and we're on the front lines of this, is to be an incredibly effective tool for violent crime. I think the track record of prosecutors on implementing Measure 11, has been remarkable in terms of exercising the proper kind of judgment that we were given the responsibility to exercise in the first place. In our opinion, there isn't anything that the state government has done in the last 15 years that's been more successful in terms of serving the public than Measure 11. Nothing for the cost. We feel that strongly about it. However, DAs have also been willing to step up and make changes to Measure 11 along the way when we thought it was the right thing to do. As you've heard, we've done that with 1049 for, I think, 8 crimes in Measure 11, where now the court can consider dropping out of Measure 11 for secondary crimes, excluding sex crimes. And we have proposed in this session to you House Bill 3341, which would include some additional crimes in second degree and sex abuse in the first degree. These are not easy things for us to do. I think if you heard my testimony, you remember me saying that. But we think it's the right thing to do after considering it carefully. We prefer that kind of approach where we're involved and we get a chance to express to you our support or lack of support of these ideas, and not a sort of just slash of Measure 11, because we think that would be a mistake in terms of public policy and in terms of saving the public and protecting them from crime. So thank you. I'd love to answer any questions you have. Appreciate
that. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I got a couple. The graphs are really helpful. My first question is to you, Steve. What year, and let me preface this by saying, my hunch is that any interpretation of this graph, particularly the second graph with the blue and the red lines, would be, I could predict someone's interpretation of it almost entirely by their support or opposition to the issues in general, right? My guess is that the color of our glasses will have as much to do with our interpretation of the data as anything on the page. That said, Measure 11 was passed in 89?
Measure 11 was passed in 1994.
94.
Went into effect in 1995.
Great. Thanks very much. The flatness... And you explain this, and I apologize, this ends up meaning just repeating yourself, but where Oregon is flat and the rest of the country starts going up and then starts going down, what was your sense of what caused it to start going up, it looks like, in 1989, and then dipping down in, as you said, about 1992? The 1992 was the 33 states.
You're talking about the red line?
The red line, yeah. So
well, you know what? I would attribute it to coke and gangs.
Yeah.
I would also say this, I just to make this clear, I don't think this is part of your question, but I want to make it clear to the committee that these numbers are not something that Crime Victims United dreamt up.
Sure, no, no,
these, I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew that these are from the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and these are from the FBI Crime Index.
Yeah, and the only reason I mention it is that, and I say that my guess is people read the lines differently. What is interesting to me is that we were staying flat while the rest of the country was going up and then down. And then we started going down. It was the exact same time the rest of the country was going down. And I hear that maybe that's because all the other states were also doing things like Measure 11. But that was my first question. I just wanted my dates right. You answered that question. Second question. Chair, thanks. To Mr. Foote, I'm sure working in association as yours with, I'm sure, a diverse range of viewpoints. There have been some folks in your association who supported decreasing the second degree Measure 11 offenses. Is that even true? I don't even know if that's true. And to the extent it's true, who were those folks? Where were they?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, I'm not sure which one you're talking about. You're talking about the previous 1049 or the current bill in front of
you? Either one. Either one or both.
The initiative usually comes from a smaller group of DAs who then introduce it to the larger group where it's vetted. Mm-hmm. And typically what happens before it moves forward, the DAs get on board. And that's really, most everything we support or oppose is based on practical experience. We fundamentally believe, and I understand what you're saying about which side of the line you're on as to how, whether why you think this happened, crime dropped. But we honestly think there is a, this is the safest Oregon I have ever practiced law in.
Right.
I don't want to throw that away.
Right.
I don't want to be reckless with that. And while I can certainly understand folks, and I know many folks believe that this was something other than
measure 11,
I think the concurrence of the two is irrefutable, and we should not ignore that or disregard it. And we do so at our jeopardy, because we've lived when we didn't have this.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no ability, or very limited ability, to do anything with violent offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And not even mentioning the impact on victims who went to court and saw that happen.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I want to try to my question again. The but before I respond to what you said, I mean, I've heard folks say that the best explanation is that when abortion was legalized, because that meant there were fewer kids being born into families who didn't want them, right? I've heard a variety of explanations for the drop and rises in crime rates, and the
okay.
and so I try to parse the data as best I can,
right.
You know. But my question for you is, I'm sure it starts from a small group of people. The small group of people who were supportive of either the previous changes or this, you know, who are those folks? Where are they from?
Well, it's myself, Multnomah County, and I'm trying to think. I was the volunteer to testify. I think, to be honest with you, when you're stepping off this ledge, before you actually see how it works, in our business, it feels like you have to be very careful. You're infecting a lot of lives, a lot of people's safety. So I think initially you have fewer people supported. But if you look back at what happened to 1049, it's proven to be a wise decision and hasn't affected our ability to protect people and has saved the state about $145 million over 10 years.
Great.
So it was a smart thing to do. But at the time, it wasn't
right.
As purely vetted, clear, as much vetted as it is now.
Right. Thanks very much. That was my question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question on the same graph, actually. I think there are kind of two significant points. One, of course, would be 1995, and then the other one, I think, of equal if not greater significance, because it's counter-cyclical to the rest of the country, would be 1985 as opposed to 95. What happened in 1985 there? That's kind of where the Oregon... This graph right here.
Okay. Oregon or national?
See, in 1985, it's the U.S. violent crime rate and the Oregon violent crime rate were approximately equal.
Synced up.
Yet then the two, there was a key inflection point there. And I'm wondering, assuming that we can attribute a single causal variable to these data, which is, I think, clearly a challenging assumption, but assuming we can, what do you think caused that in 1985?
I would say that the truth is we're not sure. And the truth is, affecting people's behavior is very complicated. The lab that I see, where I think the proof is irrefutable about aggressive intervention and laws, is where New York City dropped their violent crime rate by 70-some percent over a period of about 5 years, and it is stuck. And you don't do it by walking away from aggressive prosecution, investigation, or arrest. You just don't get there any other way. That's what it says to me. Now, they had what's called the broken windows theory here,
right.
which is not directly related to this. But I think they are related in the sense that you are targeting the right people and you are incapacitating them, whether for smaller sentences or in the terms of violent crime, for bigger sentences. That would be my best guess. I don't know why it went up.
Yeah.
I'd rather not.
If I could, and I can't explain why those synced up. What... I think what's important on these charts is this, is that if you look at the first chart again, if you look at that period between 1960 and 1985, when that 7.9 or 800% increase in the rate of violent crime took place, and when you look at the state's lack of response to that, and I could go tell you lots of stories about that. If you ever really want to see something, go into the archives across the street or down the mall and look up the violent crime task force that was put together in the mid-80s and read through that, and it'll be an eye-opener for you. Not once in there did they talk about laying down one brick or one mortar.
The other thing is that on the second chart, and maybe I didn't make this clear enough, I think the two things that are most interesting is that the year measure or the year after Measure 11 passed is exactly when we started to see that drop off. And back, if you look at the red line for the national violent crime rate, remember these are only violent crime rates here. They don't include property crimes or statutory crimes. That if you look at around 89-90, that's when it peaked and started to drop. But that's when all these other states, if you look to California and these other 33 states across the nation that in one way or another changed their sentencing guidelines or whatever their statutory schemes were, and the 23 states, some in addition to those, that imposed three strike and you're outlaws, which are quite draconian, that on that third felony you get a 25 to life sentence. That's when this whole thing turned. And I think those are the three things to keep in mind when looking at these charts.
Chair Barker, if I could add one other thing to that. The Criminal Justice Commission report of 2007 talks a great deal about the cost-benefit of incarceration. And it reflects the fact that if you do the right job with locking the right people up, you save money. It's an investment, but you save money. And the savings is much greater in violent crime versus property crime, which you would expect. And that's, in fact, where our major investment has been in the last 12 years. So I think that there's lots of evidence. We don't necessarily always understand why crime happens. It doesn't ever happen for a good reason. But we've seen patterns where we can do things to affect it.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
So first of all, the correlation, I think, between the passage of Measure 11 and the rapid decrease in violent crime in Oregon is undeniable. That correlation is a fact. It is obvious. The causation, I haven't the foggiest idea. There are two key inflection points here, 1985 and 1995. We quite easily ascribe a causal relationship or imply a causal relationship in 1995. We have no even hypothesis that I've heard for the one in 1985. Broken Windows was published in 1982. Granted, it was not, I don't believe, enforced in a large scale until New York, I believe, in 1991 or 1992. It's just, these data are remarkably complex. I'm just extremely reluctant to prescribe them any meaning without just more rigorous analysis.
One of the things that John brought up in the Criminal Justice Commission report that I think is important is this, that what we know is that from because of our, and this isn't just Measure 11, this is all incarceration in the state of Oregon, that because of the incarceration rates that we've had, we're saving from 2004 forward 100,000 crimes per year. 100,000 new crimes per year. We also know this. We only send 23% of all convicted felons to prison in this state. 77% of convicted felons get probation. That's not Crime Victims United talking, that's the Criminal Justice Commission. And last but not least, for every dollar we invest, we get $4.35 back in violent crime. But I think it's important for those who think we're over-incarcerating to remember that number. 77% of convicted felons in this state get probation.
Thank you. One more. Those numbers, I guess we'll take you at your word. I sincerely hope
the Criminal Justice Commission.
Okay, I would love to see him.
That includes probationers and parolees sent back to prison, not just first-time offenses.
With respect, and you know I have a genuine respect for all three of you, I hope and trust that the statistical analysis behind those numbers is more rigorous than the statistical analysis we've heard today with these charts. Respectfully.
Steve, you just got out the number I was going to ask you about, the 100,000 victims. But what I haven't heard is when you have a victim, many of those victims, because of what they've experienced, start having a societal cost. I wonder if you could talk about that. You know, a woman who's been raped, and then she deals with this. Can any of you speak to, do you have any way of measuring that cost? besides the human suffering. I'm talking about the actual dollar cost. If you could measure that, I think we're making money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's the question for the ages. There's been a lot of different studies out on that. There was a study out I saw some years ago that said for every felon we left on the streets, it was costing the country, the nation, $400,000 approximately. I think it was $426,000. I've seen numbers just all over the place. A lot of times the studies don't get into the psychological damage and the long-term damage. They leave that out there because they say it's not something that can be measured. But if you take those rape crimes, the damage that I've seen, the damage in talking to people who have been raped, you get involvement in crime itself. Unlike some people say they all become rapists. That's just not true. There's a small minority of them that turn to rape themselves. But they get involved in property crime. They get involved in drug crimes. They cut themselves. Young girls that cut themselves, generally, not always, but generally, are women who have been sexually abused or molested in some manner or form. Fallout in relationships, not being able to sustain relationships. It just goes on, and it's a very tough thing to calculate.
But there is a cost.
There's definitely a cost.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the association between crime going down in Measure 11, I don't think anybody's disputing that there is some effect there. The question is, what is the effect? And if I recall correctly, the Criminal Justice Commission did say that 13% of the decrease in violent crime could be associated with Measure 11. I also want to get on the record and underline that the decrease in second-degree offenses, this was an idea that was proposed to me by the District Attorney's Association in 2007. But my question, John, is when we talk about the downward departure on 1049, I think it's important for people to know how that works in the real world of your offices and the courtrooms. Isn't it true that the way this plays out mostly is that defense and the prosecutor will agree to a plea negotiation that is, and this kind of becomes a middle step between a Measure 11 mandatory sentence and and somewhere else to get you to an agreed upon plea negotiation that you then go in and present to the judge? It's pretty rare, isn't it, that these things actually go to trial and then the judge uses their discretion to downward depart?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, that's a fair question. I would start by saying that that's true of 90% of all the criminal cases we prosecute. Sure. That's the way it works. We make an offer. They decide whether to take it. If they don't, we can't reach agreement to go to trial. Most of the time, most cases, criminal cases, we reach agreement. In my courthouse, we have 11 judges and 7,000 cases a year. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't get anything done. So we try and balance justice with reality. Measure 11 is no different. And, in fact, the 1049 is really no different. The only real difference is that there is a part of the law that says a defendant might be eligible for 1049. And when we look at our facts in each individual case, we're looking at how the law applies to the case as we do in every. And if we see that that's a possibility, we negotiate it. So, and that would be true no matter how, whatever law was passed. That's just the reality. The defendant works for the best result. We work for our best result. So it's really no different, but it does work that way, yes.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask you guys about how the terms were selected in Measure 11, the terms themselves for the minimum sentences. We could accept for the sake of discussion that there is a causal relationship between the enactment of Measure 11 and the decrease in the crime rate. And we can attribute that to Measure 11 for the sake of discussion. But it doesn't necessarily follow logically that it's the exact term specified in the measure that accounts for that. In other words, 70 months might not be a magic number. Is there any data or evidence to support 70 months versus 60 or any other number?
I'd be willing to take a shot. Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I want to be completely frank and say that, first of all, these are not magic numbers. In the first, we didn't pick them to start with. Everyone can sit in a room and think about what they would think was the magic number, but these have become very important numbers in the criminal justice structure that we have because they are protected from being reduced, which quite frankly was the pattern in this state for 25 years. As the pressure of the budget increased, the pressure to reduce sentences passed along with it. And we don't want to go down that road again. We just simply don't want to go that road again. We think that is a road filled with more victims, more crime, and all the effects that follow from that. So these numbers have become symbolic in that sense. If different numbers had been picked, we would have supported them exactly the same way. They are protected from being interfered with. And we've appreciated that. We think that's become more and more important over time, and we'd like to not see that reversed. So that's a quite candid, my candid analysis of it.
Chair Barker, if I might add something
please.
To that. Representative Garrett, members of the committee, if you plot the age of a defendant against the crime, you're going to find a bell curve. It just goes like that. If you can reach age 29 to 32, you're at the low end over here. The crime is way down. If we didn't have kids, we'd have a lot less crime. Now, obviously, we're going to have kids, and I'd suggest that's a good thing. So, if you incarcerate somebody, oh, by the way, when you go up the bell curve, the last time I looked at it, age 15 and 3 months, you're right here moving just about over to the peak, okay? I haven't looked at that curve recently, but I doubt it's changed very much. And so if you incarcerate somebody for a significant period of time, you're going to push them down the backside of the bell curve. Now, I'm not saying there's a cause and effect there. I don't know. I just know that the older people get, they burn out on crime. So the difference between 70 months and 58 months, well, that's going to get you down the backside of the bell curve a little farther because they've got to be, you know, pretty much for the most part 18 years or older. So just a thought for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate what Mr. Harcourt is saying. Generally, if you're older, you're less likely to engage in antisocial behavior. There's countervailing pressures, though, to that as well, that you can, you know, protective factors and risk factors associated with it, too. And one of the things that we found in the Public Safety Strategies Task Force in the interim is that you can, if you incarcerate someone for too long, you can sever all real social ties that they have to the community and increase their likelihood of recidivism if and they described it as a U-shaped curve when it comes to recidivism. So there's tensions between various theories and hypotheses, and also want to recognize that the same Criminal Justice Commission study that Mr. Dole mentions also talks about diminishing returns of incarceration, that once you incarcerate a certain number of people, you're kind of going farther and farther down on the food chain of what kind of anti-crime effect you have in your incarceration tools.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I think that study does show, and I understand the information my colleague, Mr. Huckerode, is talking about. A couple exceptions to that. Sex crimes have changed to sort of the paradigm about where we look for crimes. If you look to populations of prisons, they're a lot older than they used to be because we're much more aggressive about sex crimes than we used to be. That's one thing. And the other is we don't just sentence people because we're trying to prevent crime. If you're in the system, you know that we're trying to sentence people to create a sense of justice for everybody involved, which has a cumulative effect over time. And in the 80s, quite frankly, that was destroyed. Nobody had a sense of justice who had anything to do with the public safety system. And we have restored that in the last 15 years, the last 20 years, including sentencing guidelines, which was a first step. So while I recognize preventing crime and looking at risk factors is important, it's not, be honest with you, when we sentence someone, that is the second thing we look at. The first thing is, what's the proportional punishment for the crime, that everyone in general will walk out of the courtroom feeling that's a fair result that we can achieve as prosecutors. Just thought I'd add that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Green.
You talk about 15 to 29. What happens at 29? You can't run as fast as when you were 15. And there's one other thing. I tell my grandchildren, I says, the average male's brain doesn't engage till 30.
Mr. Chair, I'm 29, I should add.
He's close.
Thank you very much, panel. Next, Representative Shields, if you could go up and bring up a panel and talk about second look and also the reducing sentences by 1%.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure that the 2678 was going to be on the agenda. My apologies. Why don't we jump into the second look if we could? And I think the Partnership for Safety and Justice is primarily taking care of that.
Okay. If we could do the whole thing at one time, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just introduce the concepts.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no, come on.
Yeah.
It is 2678. Correct.
I'm old, I can't remember. Unlike Martin, who's young and can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity. Just in the last couple of days, I asked Representative Krieger to add to the agenda House Bill 2678. And the notion behind that is that, again, that we need to have balance in our criminal justice system. And what the effect of that bill would be to reduce all sentences by 1%. And then take that 1% that would otherwise primarily be flowing to our prison system, and then the Department of Corrections would make a calculation every biennium of how much savings has happened through that, and then take it to the Criminal Justice Commission to have the money dispersed to programs that decrease delinquency, similar to Representative Smith's bill on the surcharge. Hopefully this will not be as popular as yours. And that's the gist of it. I appreciate the chance to put those comments on the record. And why don't we hand it off to the panel to discuss second look.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Shields.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Shannon White. I'm the Associate Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. And we want to thank all of you for making time for this informational hearing on the concept of second look hearings for youth, that's incarcerated youth. I want to just quickly mention that I am new back to Oregon. I've been back here for a year. I've spent 15 years in Louisiana, 10 of which were dedicated to improving the juvenile justice system there. Happy to say that our juvenile justice system is in much better shape. But I'm excited, actually, to talk to you today about Second Look for Youth, which I think is a really important policy for you all to consider, particularly as we move forward in this economic crisis. Second Look is an existing policy that we believe needs to be expanded to a greater number of youth. It is a policy that can save the state money and reduce recidivism, and recent polling has found that the concept of Second Look has significant public support. I just want to take a second first to explain it for those of you who don't know what it does. It is a really straightforward policy that would apply to incarcerated youth who have been convicted as adults and are serving mandatory minimum sentences. Under Second Look, youth who have served half of their sentence return to the trial court for a hearing. At the hearing, the sentencing judge reviews correctional records, hears from victims and others, and evaluates the youth on established criteria, which are written out in statute, to determine if he or she can be safely supervised in the community. The burden is on the youth to prove that he or she has been rehabilitated and reformed and can be safely supervised, safely released on supervision. I know you all have heard from some of my colleagues at Partnership for Safety and Justice, and we try to make sure that every policy we come out in favor of or oppose considers both the people who have committed crimes and the victims and survivors of crime. Second Look is a policy that takes victims and survivors of crime into consideration. If you look at the existing Second Look statute, Victims are required to be given notice of the hearing and are given a voice at that hearing. It is also my understanding from conversations with Oregon Youth Authority staff that they do work with convicted youth and victims of crime in a process called clarification. So we believe there is adequate consideration of the victims in the Second Look policy. Second Look is really good policy. As you'll hear from Ken Ross to my right here, who works at an Oregon Youth Authority facility, they need staff need incentives to get youth to continue to do well in their treatment programs. It is also smart policy, as I said. If applied retroactively, we estimate that Second Look could save millions in the next biennium. And it is tested policy that works. Youth who currently receive Second Look hearings have a recidivism rate that is half of the Oregon Youth Authority or Department of Corrections average rate. And you'll see, if the packets come around with my testimony, the second page is a document from the Department of Corrections with Cindy Booth to my right. It's going to go over next on how they evaluate that recidivism data. And it's really an astonishing statistic, actually, that youth who get tried as adults could do so well. Nationally, studies have found that youth who are tried and convicted as adults are actually more likely not only to commit future violent crimes, but to commit more violent crimes. And you'll see the second page in your packet is a summary of a national study by the Centers for Disease Control that found that if we are trying to prevent future violent crime, trying and convicting youth as adults is bad policy because it actually increases the likelihood that youth will commit future violent crime. Oregon, on the other hand, is clearly doing something right for these group of youth who currently get Second Look to have such a low recidivism rate. When Measure 11 passed, as we heard earlier, Oregon responded actually incredibly wisely by allowing youth who are convicted as adults to remain in Oregon Youth Authority facilities until the age of 25. That is undoubtedly why Second Look has been so successful with the population to which it currently applies. Second Look for youth who are not currently eligible would be a last review for young people who are likely to be transferred to an adult facility. We know that too often, rather than being rehabilitative, adult prisons can be places where young people are exposed to extremely negative influences and violence. So not only is this a smart policy and a policy that could save us money and reduces recidivism, but polling done by Grove Insight in March of 2009 in a digital dial poll found that 62% of the public support giving youth hearings when the crimes, 62% of the people polled support youth having a hearing halfway through their sentences for serious violent crimes. 66% support giving youth hearings when the crimes were defined as less serious, and less serious included things like assault and robbery. And you'll see there the third document in the packet you have is the copy of the polling information from Grove Insight. This is also consistent with national polling, which is also, it's the final document there, which has found that the public, by and large, do not believe that youth, there should be a blanket policy that allows youth to be tried and convicted as adults. So just to sum up, we at the Partnership for Safety and Justice do not minimize the impact of crimes committed by youth who would be eligible for Second Look. We know that these crimes cause harm to individuals, families, and communities, and that youth must be held accountable and face serious consequences for the harm they have caused. But they must also be given incentive to actively participate in treatment, to do better, and to succeed. Second Look promotes public safety and can save the state money at a time when it is desperately needed. And if applied retroactively, it would not only save the state money, but give OIA the flexibility it needs to choose the youth who are most ready to be released, given the imminent bed closures at OIA. We are all best served when youth who are incarcerated are not only held accountable for their actions, but given the greatest chance to be returned to our communities, able to grow and thrive. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, my name is Cindy Booth. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections Transitional Services Division, and I was asked to be here today to share with you a little of the background with regard to the current Second Look process as it applies to young offenders who are committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections after waiver and adjudication in adult court for certain crimes. The second look process provides that a person who has been committed to the legal custody of DOC, having committed an offense while they were under the age of 18, can, after serving at least 24 months of their sentence or at the halfway point of their sentence, be eligible for a second look hearing before the court. The Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority, if the person is so placed there, notifies the court that a second look hearing is required, and a hearing is scheduled where the court will make findings as to whether or not the person should be released on conditional release or that they should continue incarceration and complete their entire sentence in prison. The purpose of the hearing is to determine whether or not the young person has been rehabilitated and reformed, no longer a threat to the safety and security of the victim or the victim's family or community, and whether or not they will comply with the conditions of supervision. If they are conditionally released, they are supervised by the local community corrections agency for the remainder of the time that they would have served in prison, and then they begin their post-prison supervision period. If their second look is denied, they are returned for incarceration, and they complete their sentence as originally imposed. The Partnership for Safety and Justice asked the Department of Corrections to prepare some data with regard to the history of second look to date, and we worked with the Oregon Department of Justice and the Oregon Youth Authority to compile that data, and that is included in Ms. White's testimony. The Department of Justice began tracking second look hearings approximately 1998. The data to date through the end of 2008 would indicate that approximately 307 second look hearings have been scheduled. 172 of those resulted in a conditional release, and 111 conditional releases were denied. And based on the Department of Corrections data for those conditionally released, 172, it's a recidivism rate of approximately 17.6%, and the current DOC recidivism rate is, I believe, 30.8% as of this month. And the adult recidivism...
Excuse me.
Ms. Cook, or Ms. Booth, I'm sorry, Cindy. Could you tell us what kind of crimes, the 17.6, were they violent person-to-person?
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnett, the recidivating offenses ranged from assault to there were some sex abuse crimes and robbery, theft, and driving offenses were other categories that were included. We can get that specific detail to the committee if you have interest in knowing the detail behind that. It is included in the Partnership for Safety and Justice. Just in closing, the to clarify, the adult recidivism measure is a conviction for a new felony offense within 3 years of release from prison.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Honorable members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Ken Ross, and I've been asked to express the support of the governor and OIA for the expansion of the Second Look program. However, the rest of my comments today are on behalf of SEIU Local 503 and myself. I worked for the Oregon Youth Authority for a little over 10 years. I currently work out at McLaren. I know some of you folks through the tours that y'all have done out there, and you've seen the good work that we've done. as you probably know, and some of our conversations that we've had, many of the youth offenders I work with have successfully completed their treatment, education, and restitution requirements, and are ready to transition out in the community. But right now, in particular, five of the youth I work with on my unit are they're being warehoused, essentially. I mean, they're just sitting there doing dead time. And, you know, two of the youth I was a primary staff for, you know, they finished their treatment probably 2 years ago. And so they're going to either get released from us or go to the adult prison and get released. And, you know, there's really not a lot of hope for those guys to, you know, be paroled and be released and transition to the community, especially with the budget crisis that we have. Because right now they're talking about closing down beds, and they've already put out a notice to the youth that they're probably going to get sent upstate if we have a bunch of closures. So got a lot of real concerned youth out there. In addition to, you know, why I think this is bad for just warehousing youth, that's actually the good news, is that they've completed their treatment. But the bad news is that a lot of these youth offenders are afraid to be sent to prison and to be exposed to the hardcore adult offender culture in the prison. So since Measure 11, there's been a real increase in gang activity in OYA. And, you know, a lot of the youth are to prepare themselves to survive the transition to adult prison are joining gangs, or they're forming gangs. And, you know, one of the ways that the youth earn their stripes and get into a gang is to commit an assault on other youth and staff. So, you know, this has been a real tough period for us lately with the rise in the gang population. We've had to take a lot of extra measures to, you know, stop the gang activity. We've got a lot of correspondence coming from the adult prison to the youth trying to encourage them to join gangs and to earn their stripes. So it's really tough. And, you know, just to give you some insight into how difficult it is for the youth out there, just to complete treatment, never mind the gang and the survival piece. But, you know, I've worked with these guys in very intensive treatment for years, and, you know, they start out, they have to go through all their crimes that they've done, they have to talk about their family history, they have to talk about abuse that they've endured with their families, and that's tough, it's very challenging. And then as Shannon talked about with the clarification piece, you know, they have to own their whatever their committed offense is. And oftentimes that requires them coming face-to-face with their victims. You know, they come in and they sit down with them and have to be confronted and take ownership for what they've done. And that's a tough process. But it's really hard to buy into, you know, being willing to do that when, you know, you're more concerned about survival. And the youth are increasingly, you know, less invested in treatment, you know, right now, and more concerned about how do I survive the transition to the prison. The best way that I've seen the programs in OYA work, and this is what the adjudicated youth have as an option, is that they complete their treatment at the facility, at a closed custody facility. They complete their education component, and then they transition out to a work-study vocational camp. And, you know, when they're ready, then they start to transition out to the community under parole supervision. And this has been very successful. But the youth that don't have second look, they don't have that option. So when they finish their sentence with us, or they finish it upstate, which could be a real possibility with the budgetary crisis that we're in, they're not going to transition the community. They're not going to slow play. They're not going to go to the camps. They're not going to go out on parole and be supervised, and if they screw up, be brought back. They're just going to be, they're going to finish their sentence, and then they're going to be out in the community. And, you know, I think that it really is going to hurt their success to not have that community oversight that we give them if they're on parole. So I think it makes really good sense, you know, to help them transition the community and give them that structure and that guidance and that ability to track them out in the community. And you know, not have to undo the tremendous value and the hard work, you know, you folks have seen us put into these youth out there at McLaren and around OYA by sending them upstate. And I think that it will also give us a lot more options for if we start closing down beds around OYA, it'll give us more options to determine, you know, who needs to be placed where. If we can give some more options to the youth that have done the work, they put the time in, they're ready to be reintegrated into society. If we can give them a second look, you know, that we can, you know, keep the offenders behind bars that need to be behind bars, and we can transition the youth that need to go out. So I really, you know, hope that you will help us create an incentive for the youth that we have in our facilities to buy into rehabilitation, to help us monitor their progress out in the community, and to save the taxpayers some money. So please consider expanding the second look option for youth offenders. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Steve Dole and John Foote.
Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. In January of 1995, then Attorney General Ted Kulongoski released a report on Oregon's juvenile justice system. He said, "Right now there are no consequences for unlawful actions. There is no certainty of punishment. There is no accountability. The result? An escalation of offenses until the conduct is so outrageous that the system is forced to respond. Is it any wonder the younger criminals consider the system a joke? Is it any wonder that Oregonians are fed up?" I want to tell you a story. And the story is about younger criminals who considered laws a joke. There was a young man in Portland who, back just prior to the passage of Measure 11, raped a three-year-old child, little girl. And I'm not talking about a sexual molestation. I'm talking about a full-on rape of a three-year-old. He was brought into court, and the district attorney asked that he be remanded to adult court for trial. The judge refused. The judge then would not send him to McLaren, would not put him on probation, but put him on bench probation, and said he had to go attend sex offender classes. Within 6 months of that crime, he was at Benson High School one night with another group of young men. They were a roving gang. They were out causing trouble. They migrated over to the Lloyd Center and encountered a young couple in their early 20s coming out of the theater. They accosted the couple, threw the young man down the stairwell, ran down the stairwell, and beat him and kicked him to the point where he's a vegetable today. He was brought in front of the judge again. District Attorney's office asked to be remanded to adult court. She refused. She did, however, send him to McLaren this time, and McLaren released him after 18 months. First degree rape, attempted murder, first degree assault, other charges, 18 months. That's the mess of the system that we had. Crime Victims United is categorically opposed to second look. Got a couple of comments. First of all, as I said in my first presentation, if you look at in second degree crimes, juveniles have this available to them. Juveniles can up front know that through the judge or district attorney they can have their sentences cut in half or more, because in many cases they get probation. So they know this up front. They don't have to wait to halfway through the sentence. There's a chart I just handed out from the OYA, that you'll see that their number of Measure 11 second-degree crimes currently at OYA is 60. The number of Measure 11 reduced second-degree crimes is 30. And I'm sorry, I don't have the number yet for the probation, because that they didn't have the number through OYA. I've got to get it through either the DOC or through the Criminal Justice Commission. But I will attempt to get those numbers for you. A couple of comments about what I heard earlier. The crimes that they're referring to that are currently getting, well, first of all, I should say this. The reason we're against second look is because you've already got something better than second look for second degree crimes. So what does that leave us with? That leaves us with first degree crimes. So let's take rape. Now, I don't know what everybody's status is up there. Some of you have wives, some of you have daughters, but I know all of you have mothers. So imagine your mother is raped under Measure 11 by a 16-year-old. First-degree rape. Remember what first-degree rape is? Violence, weapon. And he gets 8 years and 4 months for that rape. But we've got to look at her, the district attorney, the victim's assistance person, or somebody from Crime Victims United and say, yeah, he got an 8-year and 4-month sentence, because of this second look thing, at 4 years and 2 months, you're going to have to come back to court, and he may be released. It would mean going to a family who has had a brutal murder take place in their family and say, yeah, they got a 25-year sentence, but at 12 and a half years, we're going to have to come in, and they may be released. In the case of that young man that I told you about, had he been sentenced under Measure 11, he would have gotten at least 10 years under the aggravated attempted murder statute, but a judge could let him go after 5. That's why we're against it. The crimes that they talked about in the presentation that came just before ours, when they're talking about giving people second look, these are different types of crimes than Measure 11. These are not Measure 11 crimes. That's what they're after. So the assaults and the sodomies and the rapes in here have got to be third degree, I'm guessing. But they're not clear with that. They don't state it. The homicide has got to be a criminally negligent homicide. And, of course, burglary and other are not Measure 11 crimes. So I think they're doing little apples to oranges there, but I've asked Jennifer Black to get us the figures on that so we can take a look at it. One of the beauties of the system, the way we built it, is that people can stay in the OYA until they're 25 years of age. So that unless you've had somebody that has committed multiple sentences with consecutive sentences or committed a murder, they can do all their time there. And most do. I heard it alluded to that they're being sent off to the adult system. Well, the people that are sent off to the adult system have either attacked staff or another inmate, or they've completely refused treatment. Or sometimes, if they're over 18, they ask to go. It was alluded to that these people come in and they're forming gangs. I got news for you. They were in gangs before they got there. They brought the gangs into the system. They didn't create the gangs in the system. Rick Hill, the original director of the OYA, and Bob Jester, one of his successors, both said that the 1049 application is better than second look, and it is. And as I said before, I don't think that you want to go to cutting first degree offenses by 50%. Murders, rapes, armed robberies, assaults that leave people paralyzed, damaged for life. Thanks very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you again. I'm John Foote. I'm the DA in Clackamas County. And just a couple of things in perspective about the criminal justice system. First of all, the vast, vast, vast majority of juveniles are handled in the juvenile system like they always have been. That's the first thing you should know. Measure 11 and OA did not change that. They are dealing with a small percentage of all juveniles in the system. That first of all, I think that's really important to understand. Second of all, we have a provision now to deal with second degree crimes, 1049, which allows the court to consider dropping out of Measure 11, both for adults and juveniles. And as you know, we've proposed an addition, 3341, which would add some more crimes to that. And we have second look in the system now, but it doesn't apply to Measure 11. We're talking about this bill applying to a very few people. And I would encourage you to go look at the crimes they have committed, the facts of the crimes they have committed. One of the things we learned before we had OIA and Measure 11 was not every kid is a kid. Some kids are scary and dangerous at 16, 15. We couldn't get them out of the juvenile system before. And I would suggest to you, in the vast majority of cases, the people we're going to be talking about in this bill are kids like that. Kids who've done something very seriously wrong. The other thing about this system is there's been a lot of thought given into how OIA and Department of Corrections interact. And this transition from adult, from being a juvenile to an adult, and the transition back and forth, and the provision that the juvenile can stay to 25. There's a great deal of flexibility. We've got a model for the country. And I just don't understand, for policy reasons, why we would want to change this. It's good public policy. We've done good things with this. Now, there's some folks who just don't want those people, those kids, young people, incarcerated for these crimes. That's a philosophical difference. But in terms of public policy, the system we have now works well. People are exercising good judgment, and the vast majority of kids are never touched by this. This is really siphoned off a very small group that we just could not deal with before. And I would encourage you to not change the system we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, is there anybody from OIA here today?
Were those managers?
I mean, in management. Because my understanding is that while kids can stay to 25 in OIA, I think it's very close to a majority end up going to the Department of Corrections, and for one reason or another. And so, which, you know, you're absolutely right, they have the opportunity, but there are also pressures on the system that when there are fewer beds, certain behavior is tolerated less, and there are that is solely in the discretion of OIA management to do so.
The Representative, when we just were up there, they told us, though, that the main party people, some of them think they're tougher and they want to go to the pen, their brother's there, their dad's there, their friends are there, or they've assaulted staff, or they've assaulted others. So, I mean, while it's not a pleasant place, but, I mean, they can't earn their way. From what I was told there and from what my understanding, they can't earn their way to the joint if they want to go there.
Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to get an analysis from OIA about how many actually end up in DOC.
We can do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I should have said this during my testimony. I am a member of the Oregon Youth Authority Advisory Board. I have been since 1997. I don't represent the views of the board. There are people on the advisory council that are for second look. There are people who are against second look. I've seen some of the cases of kids who have assaulted people. One struck me. I was up at the North facility up at near Astoria when this, just after this happened, and it was a case where a kid picked up a pen and jabbed it through another kid's neck. And they moved him out in a hurry. So it's got to be pretty serious stuff. You don't get out of there for pushing and shoving or getting in a minor scuffle.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel, and appreciate the other people who are here today to testify. It's very helpful information, and I like the way it was presented. Everybody did a very good job of a very emotional issue and just keeping it very professional, and I appreciate that. Representative Shields?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to thank you for keeping everybody calm, and we all live to tell the tale, which I'm very pleased, and I really appreciate the way you handled this hearing.
You're more than welcome. Any further business come before the committee today? Meeting adjourned.